You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Cal Speletich. He's in San Francisco right now. Cal, thanks for talking with me today.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for thinking of me.
So, Cal, tell me, I want to ask what you're working on now, but can you just also give me a snapshot of your studio and where you are? Because I know you're in your studio at the moment. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm on the edge of the San Francisco Bay and down in the south east corner of the city. It's traditionally an old industrial neighborhood, and have had a workshop down here for 23 years.
And what are you doing in that workshop now? This is your studio. I know you do a variety of things, but is there anything particular you're working on?
I am. I'm working with a couple hacker buddies, and we're building what we're calling split brain robotics. And it's a pair of robots that are run by your brain. Specifically, the one robot is run by the right side of your brain, and the other robot is run by the left side of your brain.
So that sounds interesting. So how does that work? Or ideally, what would that mean? That's kind of hard to understand even how we would operate those.
These hacker friends got their hands on an EEG, an electrooscilograph, and that reads brain waves. It harvests brain data. And what they did was sort of dove into it and were able to get this EEG to specifically harvest data from the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere of your brain. And so, of course, your left side is your analytic kind of science math side, your logical side, and your right side is your poetic, magic, dreamy side. And often it's been said that if you can get those two sides to mesh, that is how genius works. I'm not positive that's true, but I'm very interested in working with that and experimenting with it and experimenting on live audiences with it. And so this piece is run by the audience, by a live audience who comes to see the artwork.
And does the audience interact with it individually, or can they interact with it collectively?
We can have up to two people running it at once. So, for instance, one person could run the left side hemisphere robot, and another person could run the right side hemisphere robot. And then the goal is, can you get the hemispheres to collaborate? And could you get these robots to, say, perform a task?
And this interest in, I mean, just to give a kind of perspective on how you're coming to this as an artist and as a scientist or being interested in the sciences, how did this all come together for you? Because you're not also coming from a traditional background. You didn't go to the typical art school. Is that correct?
Well, it's a long journey of, working in the arts and... how does one end up where they're at? I often think of my work as a series of experiments conducted on a live audience. And what will the audience allow me to subject them to? And what are they willing to be subjected to? And even why? Or why are people, why is an audience willingly letting me subject them to things? I've been early out, I became entranced with Marcel Duchamp and his optics experiments and him going in drag and him really questioning the natures of art. And I saw parallels to Leonardo da Vinci and Duchamp. And eventually I came to the realization that that the future of the world is going to be driven by technology. And that was, I think, in the 80s, I could tell that was going to happen. And so I thought, well, what more important thing to work in than technology? And from there, I've experimented with countless kinds of tech and really am also appalled by what technology is doing to our society. And so on one hand, I'm honoring technology and thrilled to death and excited about it and mortified by the addictive nature of, say, the internet and what cell phones are doing, these handheld stalker, really is what they are, stalker machines. And can you honor and critique something at the same time?
Well, I guess you can. I mean, because you're continuing to do that as you've continued since, I mean, as you're saying, the 80s, doing a variety of projects, and I want to perhaps jump into one of those and describe one now. Your work also seems to straddle two realms, right? You're not typically in the marketplace. Is that correct? It's not that you're selling a lot of this work or this is all bound for the marketplace. It's a lot of it is more research oriented, or how would you describe it? And what I'm asking is your interaction with the art market or the art world. A lot of people I talk to have everything from different kinds of jobs to different ways of integrating what they're doing with the world. So that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think a really important one. And how do you survive as an experimental artist in America in 2016? And that's a long answer. I mean, I feel like I could talk about that for an hour. But you have to be crafty and wily and shifty and driven. People virtually never buy my work. And I think that's sort of a goal in a way, is to mess with capitalism and do a workaround of the system I don't like. And I think capitalism is vicious and mean and cruel. And how can you do a workaround and still survive as an artist? And I've held countless jobs to be able to have be able to create this body of work and even have a lifestyle where I'm not some worker drone. And a goal of my life was to not have to get up in the morning and do something that is soul sucking and that hurts my heart.
Right. Well, so obviously you've managed and you've survived, which is commendable in itself. In that time, did some of your work go into the hands of the public, even if it wasn't sold? Is it cared for or given to people? How does it survive other than being in your studio, or does it?
That's a mixed bag. I give a lot of work away. I've sold, you know, literally 3 or 4 pieces in 35, 36 years of making art. I have shown at a lot of commercial galleries, some pretty big ones, to be honest. And, you know, what they get out of it is a lot of press and attention and that they're championing experimental work. And in the end, those sort of commercial galleries, you know, a lot of them want to be able to do that. It's just very hard economically for them to give up 6 to 8 weeks knowing they won't get any sales.
Right. And so let's talk about one of those projects, perhaps. Maybe Monkey on Your Back or another project, just so you can go through a project and kind of explain it to the listeners, and I can continue to ask you more about it, just so we can really
sure.
kind of illustrate one of
it. I collaborated with an electrical engineer here in San Francisco named Jonathan Foote, and he helped build a number of sensors for the Monkey on Your Back, and it's a backpack that you wear that has 4 arms and a tail, and you put on a pair of gloves, and it essentially harvests data from you constantly. It's reading your pulse, it's reading your skin conductivity and slight muscle movements, and the 4 arms and tail it's like a 3 foot long kind of monkey tail that hangs off the back of the backpack, and they all move almost what appears to be randomly. And like a lot of the pieces with sensors that I've done, I'm interested in a feedback system between the human volunteer and the robot, and which is in control, the human or the robot. And it's a metaphor, of course, for society. Are you in control of your life or society running you? Who's the monkey? And it's also a metaphor for addiction and drug use and my journey into that and then getting out of it. Of course, there's an old saying, you have a monkey on your back.
Right, but now this is, of course, a very different meaning of it. So how was that? So it's you created that. How is it built and then used? How did you use it or get it out there?
So I built it in my workshop and built the four arms and attached them to an old aluminum backpack frame and attached the tail to it. I often collaborate with people with a skill set beyond mine. And Jonathan's this phenomenal electrical engineer, very cutting edge, Silicon Valley, highly in demand engineer. He works on medical robotics in his day job. And I mean, a great thing about the Bay Area is I can harvest this talent pool that aren't being fulfilled with their workaday job. And they'll often come to my workshop and go, oh my God, this is what I thought I was going to do. But instead, they're in a cubicle working for the man. And so in that respect, there is, I think, you know, almost any artist can tap into a talent pool or the hive mind that is beyond yours if you find like-minded souls that aren't satisfied with, you know, their life's journey. I mean, that's where the arts can provide that, I think, for non-artists.
Well, right, and that's
not
so
sure
interesting.
Did I answer your question?
No, you are in part, and I'll ask more, but it's also the Bay Area, you're saying, is rich with technology experts, essentially, right?
It is, and then it's tapping into those folks, and some of them don't really know that there's other applications, especially sort of the younger generation. But the older generation...
You mean they don't know that there's an element where they could be creative and work with artists? Is that the element you mean?
Sure, yeah. Or even do something radical or something completely economically absurd. And I think just by doing that, you start to question their jobs and the applications of technology, and then you question capitalism.
Hmm.
So why
like
would
that. And,
so,
and,
why would someone who can make $100 an hour spend 100 hours losing money? Why would someone do that? And my answer would be to find their life work and to find the reason you're on the planet. And I often think, you know, most artists are like volunteers. They do volunteer work. They make their art and they lose money at it. But that shows they're doing their life's work.
Because they're obviously not doing it to make money out of it. It's one of the curious things about artists that they will, unlike business people, that though they're producing something that could be, you know, commodified or sold, the fact that they keep producing it even when it's not commodified or sold is, you're saying, evidence that it's their calling.
Sure. What would you do if you had $1 million? Or maybe $1 million isn't enough anymore. $10 million. Would you sit on a beach? Well, then there's your life's work. And I even often like to think if I had $10 million, I'd be doing the same thing I'm doing. Actually, hopefully I'd be doing it better and on a larger platform and definitely making the world a little weirder.
That's a good leading question. What would you do with $10 million? So that steps us back to looking at your work and other things. So what you would do is make more make the world a little weirder, as you say. But what do you mean by that exactly? Like the audience that's also experiencing your work potentially, I mean, saying you were more funded or not, is also it's often a playful activity. They're experiencing something, right?
Sure.
I mean, that doesn't seem so weird to me. It seems, you know, innovative and experimental and playful even, but maybe you have a different idea of what that means, weird or a weird world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I often reference the home I grew up in and my hometown in Iowa, and they're kind of simple folk who haven't been out of Iowa much, if at all, and think if that isn't the middle of America, nothing is. And their interpretations of my work. And in some respects, they get it easier than the art world because of the technological kind of gearhead connection. And they sort of just accept, oh, Cal's an artist. He does stuff we don't understand. And just as I would walk into a physicist's laboratory, look at the chalkboard and go, what are these scribblings? What is this, right. The work of the devil? And just because I don't understand it doesn't mean it's bad. And in fact, it means I need an education to understand it. And often I've found people in the Midwest or smaller towns know that. They know this isn't their field, and so they don't criticize it outright or feel necessarily threatened by it.
So it sounds like part of your community. That makes sense to me, and that is maybe perhaps also what defines it being weird outside of those norms, though it's understandable. It's still, you know what Cal's doing, but it could be referenced as weird. Is that what you mean?
Yes,
or,
I think
or is that
it's weird
more...
to a painter is where I'm going with it. And,
right.
So I teach on and off at universities, and I'm the weird art and technology guy at the schools, to be honest. Even, you know, like the performance artist folks kind of look at me and scratch their head. And
right.
I think it's important to do, there should be weird things in society that sort of, you just don't know. Is this a value or not? And you just, it's not clear. And
but which also moves beyond even the issue of is it art or not? We're not really talking about that issue. Also, weird things happening is also events that may not be attached to a cultural signifier, for lack of a better word, like it's art or it's theater or it's music, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I also, the split brain robotics, I mean, we can allow handicapped people to control robots. We're harvesting brain data. You don't even have to move a muscle to move a 16-foot tall robot. And, you know, that's amplifying the unseen. It's amplifying brainwaves. And I love that this could be applicable to a market economy, but we're trying to make poetry with it. And you kind of just clearly land, you demand to land in the middle.
Right, that makes sense. And so part of also your process, it sounds like it's, I don't know if it's community-based, but you're always collaborating with people. Part of what's going on in your studio is bringing in scientists and other people that you're learning from?
Definitely, yeah. And, working in robotics, you know, just the term robot is a moving target. It's ever-evolving, and as man gets better at some things, robots get even more better. And then on the flip side, humankind gets worse at some things, and robots maybe get worse or better. It's this nebulous thing that really isn't defined, and I don't think will be in my lifetime. So it's exciting to work in that and to find people that kind of get that and are interested in experimenting.
That is exciting. Before we go, I wanted to ask you, which is a question that I ask people a lot, is there a book or a blog or anything you're reading now that you want to share with us, just in terms of what it is? Could be off topic, anything at all.
Yeah, I am reading a book on a group that worked here in the Bay Area in the 60s, and the group was called the Diggers. And there's a book by one of the Diggers, Emmett Grogan, and the book is called Ringo Levio. And it's his ramblings and tales, and a lot of tall tales, I think. But that group were like the radicals in the hippie era here. And they got free food and distributed it and started free health care up in the Haight-Ashbury district that I used when I was a punk rocker 20, 30 years ago. And they really did a workaround of society and then provided locally for their community and were sort of gangsters about it. You know, they often went around and stole food to give to the people. And then they figured out deals with restaurants to get their leftovers. And people are still trying to do this in a more structured way in our society 40, 50 years later. Anyway, Ringo Levio is the book I'm reading.
Thanks for that. I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. I look forward to learning more about your work in the future, but thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, I appreciate your interest. And, you know, in the end, what is technology's role in art and our society? And can it do something deeper? Can robots be spiritual?
That's a great question, and I suppose one we're going to be pondering for a while collectively. Thanks again, Cal. I really appreciate you talking with me.
I appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.